Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is the station.
We had predicted the day before that it was going to be a massacre. Herman Badillo turned to me and said, I don't know what the hurry was. He said, there's always time to die. And I don't know what the hurry was either. You know, those guys weren't going anywhere. They were inside 30-foot walls. It was September. It was getting cold up there. The food was running out. The sanitary conditions were bad. The place smelled awful. I mean, that sense of freedom that the guys had had to begin with, but just before being out of their cells, that was beginning to wear away in the reality of their situation. I don't know what the hurry was. They could have waited 2 days, 3 days, 4 days. Those guys would have given up. They didn't have to go in and kill them all. But they did.
39 men were killed in the assault. 29 inmates and 10 hostages. Among the dead, inmate leader Elliot Barkley. 89 men were seriously wounded. Hostage Michael Smith was shot 4 times in the abdomen. 3 inmates were found stabbed to death, killed earlier by other prisoners. Initial reports by state officials that the hostages had died of slashed throats were refuted by the medical examiner.
The first 8 autopsies were on the cases identified to us as hostages. All 8 cases died of gunshot wounds.
The medical examiner's finding was significant. The inmates had no firearms. Gunfire by state troopers and prison guards was responsible for all the deaths during the retaking of the prison.
What do you do during those moments when the assault was actually taking place, the order had been given?
Well, I kept in touch by phone, and I'll never forget the moment when the report was given that 14 guards had come out alive. And
the shock, the disbelief may now be fading, but it's being replaced by a cold anger and calls for revenge.
Tattooed across my stomach, it will always be a part of me.
Tupac Shakur represented at once the expression of the evil that needed to be resisted and the need to resist that evil. This is why people were so upset with him.
Just recently, this lady wrote me named Clovis Benjamin.
That's tonight on Our Common Ground. I'm Janet Graham. I'll be listening for you.
For being with us. You are listening to Our Common Ground. I'm Janice Graham. I'm your host, and my co-host tonight is Alpho of the Alpho Show, a brother that always holds me up. Thank you so much for being with us. Tonight at Our Common Ground, we're going to be looking at the Attica Prison Rebellion. We're going to be looking at how it was more than a prison insurrection. It was a window into the time and culture that produced it, and to look at it, examine it some 37 years later offers us, activists, scholars, and non-scholars alike, an opportunity to closely look at the facet of our society that most of us rarely see. We lock away millions of people every decade in penal institutions in this country. And the case of Attica Rebellion and Revolt, their inmates rebel in our prisons and become socially and politically visible. And so it was with Attica. so do our prisons and our criminal justice systems cause pause for all of us. Also tonight, we are going to be looking at what I found was a very interesting tidbit of history, that on the very morning when Nelson Rockefeller ordered state troopers and park police to bomb and kill the revolting, rebelling brothers against the inhumane treatment of people, our dear brother, Tupac Shakur, was born September 13th. We'll talk about that, and we'll also have an opportunity to look at his birthday and at his life tonight. Also, we're going to be throwing out on the plate the ghost of George Bush, what's happening in New York City, and remembering 9/11 and what it has meant to us and how it has changed the very fabric of how we live in this country. We have the Moscovite Manhattan Klan, the burning Korans by evangelicals, and the You Are Not Like Me movement going on in this country, and we'll talk a little about that. And, of course, my mentor, friend of Our Common Ground, a frequent guest, as a matter of fact, he was the first guest that I had on a television show that I did entitled Our Common Ground back in 1987. He was our first guest. And Dr. Ron W. Walters made his transition on yesterday. And we are going to be paying tribute to the service that he gave us as a people. His genius and his brilliance and his insight, providing the leadership and the roadmap that we needed to both culturally and politically have some victories. Alpho, thank you for joining us tonight here at Our Common Ground. You are late, my brother.
I'm missing the football game. You telling me I'm...
We do not do football except for...
Good evening, Janet. Good evening to the Our Common Ground.
Yeah, say good evening to the people.
Good evening to everyone. Let's see, we've got Doc Don, India Declare. Okay.
We've got Natty Reb.
TWI. Say that again?
Natty Reb.
Natty Reb
comes and visits us quite often. She is a gray-haired witness, one of the founders of Gray Hair Witnesses, and we know her as Sister Marpessa. Love me some Sister Marpessa.
Is that Sister Marpessa?
Yeah, that's Sister Marpessa.
And her, you call
her
Natty Reb?
And we've got Navaxar with us, and we're glad to have him. We've got a lot of work to do tonight. You know, people don't think talk radio is a lot of work. Chef Ozo just came into the chat room, and for those of you who would like to join us in our chat room where there is quite a bit of robust discussion that goes on during our broadcast, you are welcome to do so at blogtalkradio.com/OCG. Alpha, how you doing? You had two really good shows today.
Well, thank you, Janice. I really wasn't in the mood. But no.
Well, you know, I thought there was some good talk going on Blog Talk Radio. India Declare show was on fire this morning.
Yes,
people
it was.
People were really thinking. I mean, November 11th is a difficult day for all of us, as we've been talking about all day. It's a very confusing and conflicting trauma.
Well, I think
that we all have.
I think it's conflicting because of the atmosphere, the tone that has been set by people who simply don't value it unless it's to their political advantage. And
mm-hmm.
that's what you're
mm-hmm.
seeing here now. You've got the two clowns, Beck and Palin. They're fleecing their own for $75 to upwards of $225 at some can get together up in Alaska, and it's for the troops. I mean, that, come on, these are just front men. These are snake oil salesmen, and you're right. It's kind of an uneasy back and forth for African Americans and Americans. We as Americans, we understand the, I would say, the solemn part of this bill.
Mm-hmm.
We also understand that, you know, it's not unwarranted. It's not, you know, something that was done out of someone. The people who did this had a reason. And I think that our foreign policy, and, you know, I'm not condoning their heinous act, especially against civilians, but these people don't see them as civilians. They
mm-hmm.
think all damage is not collateral. It's just simply damage.
Mm-hmm.
But we suffered through that, and we go on, and that's, you know, my first hour of my show today, I try to, you know, go with the theme of 9/11 and how people were feeling and et cetera, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And my second hour, I was just simply, you know, angry and just simply wanted to get at the people who have turned this into some type of political football, into some type
mm-hmm.
of profit-making,
mm-hmm.
some type of, you know, for their own political gains, and that's what you have. I can't see people or someone saying, well, they do it on the left. I just haven't seen.
Well, Alpha, you know, as I discussed with India and have been having discussions all day, I've been terribly, terribly saddened by the loss of Dr. Walters. And I, even when doing a tribute, I decided not to try to record anything because I started choking up. But one of the things that we have to consider in this country is that we either have to be who we say we are or say who we are. We cannot begin to think about, to grasp, to embrace 911, as they say, or sacred ground, until we consider what we did in response. Certainly, my heart goes out to the victims, one of whom I knew, and that we should always be sorrowful for our loss as a country. But we've got to think about what we allowed as our response. And we'll talk some more about that later on, but I do want to get on with having our audience take an opportunity to in the fabric of who we are as a country. We constantly talk politically about the prison industrial complex, and over the years. And I have been involved in justice and reform and prison reform for a very long time. I became a member of the Fortune Society, which came about as a result in 1967 of a stage play by the title of Fortune in Men's Eyes. And the Fortune Society was an organization that went all over the country advocating in the spirit of Malcolm X for prison reform to provide real and meaningful rehabilitation for prisoners while in prison and reentry programs once a prisoner is released. And we made some great strides in the 70s and early 80s. Until a guy by the name of Ronald Reagan came by. And at that point, it was all abandoned. But I think that there should not be any telling of truth about what our prisons are, what who we are as a country, without first looking at the real business of how our prisons, the real truth about how our prisons are, what we thought of our prisons and what makes up the culture of prison governance. So let's take a look, and I hope that people will talk about Attica all week. Attica began on September 9th. The rebellion began on September 9th. People would like to call it a riot. It was not a riot. It was a rebellion. And it ended in a very horrific way, a way that it didn't have to end. Here's the Our Common Ground documentary that we've put together on the Attica uprising.
Files documented extensive FBI operations against U.S. citizens and organizations, including traditional civil rights groups. Amid growing criticism of the counterintelligence program, President Richard Nixon reaffirmed his support for the FBI during graduation ceremonies at the Bureau's National Academy.
I am honored to be here to break into your graduation ceremony to reassure you and all of the men in law enforcement throughout the country of the support you have at the very highest levels in government for your work. And I am honored to speak for the entire nation in saying to you congratulations, wishing you well, in seeing that this nation is one in which we will have respect for law, in which the American people can have freedom from fear.
We had talked about police brutality. The Black Panther Party talked about the police as an occupying force in the community, but we had not really understood the extent to which the whole criminal justice system, the police, the courts, the prison system is very much intertwined with the economic oppression of Black people.
Blacks and Latinos filled the nation's prisons in disproportionate numbers. At Attica Correctional Facility in upstate New York, they comprised more than 60% of the inmate population. Most came from poor inner-city neighborhoods.
I think the system was damaging to the people that came in. And the inspiration anybody could have not to go back to, or desire not to go back to a place like that is because of what a horrible place it was.
There's always the tendency to push prisons to the fringes of our awareness so that we don't have to deal with what happens inside of these horrifying institutions.
Conditions in 1971, before the rebellion, was bad. You know, bad food, bad educational programs, very, very low wages. We were called slave wages. You know, myself, I was working in a laundry, and I was making like 30 cents a day being the warden's laundry boy, and that was the title that you had with my job, warden's boy, and I'm far from a boy.
We always thought of the jails as a kind of explosive resource for, you know, revolutionary change. Certainly people like Malcolm X had come out of prison, and the Nation of Islam had done a great job of transforming a lot of people who had been in prison. And some people in prison had, you know, been in the Panthers and things like that. So we saw revolutionary activity as a means of transforming prisoners into revolutionaries.
One of the most impassioned voices to emerge was George Jackson's. His published letters from prison had reached a wide audience. On August 21st, 1971, Jackson was shot to death in San Quentin Prison in California. At Attica, the news of his death greatly affected the inmates.
When it really hit me, it's going to breakfast that morning. Everybody was quiet. Nobody wasn't picking up no silverware. You know, when you go in the dining room, in the mess hall, you had to pick up a knife, spoon, and fork. And when you come out, you had to have that. Nobody was picking up. Nobody was talking.
I don't know that I can describe in words how it affected me, because George was, in effect, my mentor. I remember his going to court in shackles. And the brother would stand erect, you know, proud black man that he was. And they had not broken his spirit. And these are the things that Dr. King and Malcolm talked about, the breaking down of the black man's spirit.
3 weeks later, a fight between inmates and guards at Attica sparked a prison-wide uprising. Violence swept through the institution.
An estimated 1,000 prisoners took over square cell blocks of Attica State Prison, about 930 this
morning. The general chaos was such that even I was taken aback, because you had 40 or 50 correction officers who no longer, it appeared, had control of the institution. So order had to be made out of this disorder. And at that point, the Muslim contingent in the yard, I think there were 35 Muslim brothers, saw to it that there was no further injuries to the hostages.
The newly established inmate leadership released 11 injured guards, but still held hostage 39 prison employees. Commissioner of Corrections Russell Oswald agreed to negotiate. Accompanied by advisors and the local television crew, he entered the yard where 1,200 inmates were in control.
Take it as we walk. Take it as you walk. Take it as you walk. Make sure you get that roof. Take it as you walk.
The news team was permitted to talk to the hostages.
Been treated all right?
Yes, I have so far, but you're hurting.
No complaints, but no problem.
The meeting with Commissioner Oswald quickly focused on inmate fear of reprisals for the rebellion.
The fact now that the sheriff's department, the various counties, and the state troopers have taken over, because it has been declared now a state of emergency. You couldn't guarantee no reprisal anyway. This is now out of your hands, isn't it, Commissioner?
No, it is not.
You still control the state troopers?
Absolutely.
All right, now, you want to put your no reprisals in writing?
Yes.
Would you stop doing that?
I talked as rationally as I could with them and listened to them for some period of time, and ultimately, they said they had an agenda of what they wanted. And I said, well, give me the agenda.
The agenda included demands for improved conditions. The inmates called for educational programs, an end to censorship of letters and magazines, adequate health care, and hiring of black and Spanish-speaking guards. Distrustful of state officials, the inmates also asked for outsiders to observe negotiations.
The Prison Solidarity Committee of New York, Minister Farrakhan from the Muslims. We want Huey P. Newton from the Black Panther Party, and we want the chairman of the Young Lords.
In all, the inmates requested 13 observers.
I felt good. You know, I felt relieved. I felt, I guess, liberated, you know, that I didn't have to worry about the bar in the front of me, even though I knew that I was, I felt and knew that I was in prison. Now, that's the reality. But that visible thing wasn't there no more. You know, the walls was there, but that bar wasn't really in the front of me, that visible bar. It was more invisible there.
Wait, till you get the cue. Come on, it's on now. All of us here realize that wherever there's that struggle, there's sacrifice.
The next morning, Commissioner Oswald returned to the yard, still seeking a negotiated solution to the crisis.
I talked with the governor's legal counsel yesterday, and he told me the same as Mr. Schwartz told me, and that is that the governor nor no one else has the power to grant amnesty for the commission of a crime, and that's the falls within the purview of the local law enforcement authorities.
Now, you and I know that's a lie.
Amnesty was very important to the inmates because it, to a great degree, would determine what happened to them after the state took over, or whether or not there was going to be a peaceful kind of takeover, and subsequently how they would be treated.
The talks had reached an impasse. Tensions in the yard increased.
We have been asking for over 29 hours for food and water. We haven't got none. We're going to keep Mr. Russell, Russell G. Oswald here until we got the food and water.
As soon as I get back there, the food is brought into this yard.
Protected by the inmate security force, Commissioner Oswald left the yard. The hopes of both sides now rested on the outside observers who arrived in Attica later that day.
Who lived down a long corridor which had been trashed and burned out in the initial rioting. I mean, the first feeling of shock, I think, for sort of a sedentary middle-class person like me was the feeling of being out of reach of the law that one ordinarily thinks protects you, you know, that sort of protection we all take for granted until you don't have it. And all of a sudden I realized that there wasn't anything in there to protect me except these other inmates, and these inmates whom it's all too easy to think of, you know, as murderers and thieves and so forth. And that is a somewhat scary feeling, there's no question. But very shortly after that, we all got down to business of trying to, you know, work out the problems there. The inmate leaders got into some very fervid oratory. They were great orators.
We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be driven or beaten as such. The entire prison populace has set forth to change forever the ruthless brutalization and disregard for the lives of the prisoners here and throughout the United States. What has happened here but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed?
The moment I saw him speak on television, I said to myself, Charlie, what have you done? What are you doing? Because I felt that they would make him pay for that and pay dearly.
The first meeting of observers and inmates lasted almost till dawn. A public address system set up in the yard kept the 1,200 inmates informed.
There was a sense of hope that if for the first time there were some outsiders, people would now begin to listen, and hopefully some changes could be made.
On Saturday, the third day of the uprising, troopers surrounding the prison yard waited for a decision by the state. Using a video camera, they recorded the activities of the inmates.
And there is the ugliest, blackest Negro gentleman I've ever seen in my life in that black outfit. Boy, when they painted him dark.
The man doing the speaking is wearing a bright red robe. He's just gotten several very loud responses from the crowd. Typical rabble-rouser type talk.
It was a good feeling, you know, and especially after we start dealing and start organizing and start talking about the conditions and start talking about why we were out there and start talking about the grievances and start talking about why we were rebelling and why rebellion was necessary, the feeling became more and more and more into me. And I start feeling a part of it more.
Ain't nothing dead about us. We ain't gonna die. Nothing. We are not.
It was almost a community within a community. And it was somewhat very, very impressive that they said, this is our home and we're now going to make it as livable as possible. And there was a tremendous amount of discipline there within the yard.
Families and friends of the hostages gathered outside the prison walls, waiting for news. Relatives and supporters of the inmates demonstrated nearby. That evening, the mood in the yard changed. William Quinn, a guard hurt in the initial takeover, had died in the hospital. Governor Nelson Rockefeller and Commissioner Oswald had earlier agreed to most of the demands concerning prison conditions, but rebelling inmates could now face murder charges unless amnesty was granted. The next day, state troopers moved into position to retake the prison, if ordered.
Time is 1:55 p.m. We're on the roof of C Block, looking at a detail of 270 marksmen with instructions to clear the catwalks upon command.
We thought that the situation reached crisis, that in fact there was about to be an attempt to retake the prison. We thought that there would be a lot of bloodshed. In fact, we said to the governor that if that happened, there would be a massacre. And his response was that basically that he sympathized with our position. He felt that everything had been done that could be done. He was very, anyone who remembers Governor Rockefeller will remember his effusive manner. And he was very, he thanked us greatly for our efforts and that sort of thing. But the net effect of it was that, that he felt everything had been done that could be done. He could not grant amnesty and, in fact, said that even if I could, I wouldn't do it.
With negotiations deadlocked, inmates requested black and Latino reporters and a member of the establishment press. It was an attempt to speak directly to the public.
Y'all dudes running around here shooting that dope. Running around here shooting that dope. Getting high, raping them sisters, them white folks, and justifying it in the cause of revolution. Well, we're going to die here at Attica, today or tomorrow. And we ask you to get together, get our people together, and unite.
The people in here are treated like dogs. Not only the black, the Puerto Rican, and the white. And we're going to get what we demand, or we're going to die trying.
And I want you brothers to get together, because we together here. And we, these people think we shucking and jiving, but we is for real. All these dogs up there with all those rifles are trying to kill us. But we ain't going to quit. You know we're not. Why no? We're not gonna quit because we're one. We're one unit. We're tired of being beaten. We're tired of being oppressed. We're gonna get this if we all have to die. All of us.
You are ready to die.
On the die on it.
The hostages appealed to the state not to come in, not to kill. That the inmates' requests were. Were right on that last day we were there. I mean, it was a very emotional kind of exchange from the hostages and from everyone.
I just hope that the commissioner and the other people in the committee that they've gathered together can come up with a solution to solve these people's problems and ours.
I'll tell you what I got to say. We've stood out here since Thursday, and my son is in there. Michael Smith is one of the hostages. I've talked to several of other people here that have husbands in there, and some of the fathers. And I can't speak for all of them, but my feelings are this. You can only pacify a kid with a pacifier so long. At 3 o'clock this afternoon, we was led to believe that there was going to be a definite decision. They was going to bring them out. Now, damn it, I'll do it.
Monday morning, day 5. Commissioner Oswald demanded the immediate release of the hostages. In response, the inmates positioned 8 of the hostages on the catwalk. By their side stood inmates armed with knives and clubs, threatening to kill the hostages in case of an attack. I was led blindfolded to the top of the catwalk, and I can recall when that helicopter flew overhead. Besides being able to hear it, you could actually feel the concussion of the propellers from the helicopter overhead.
We knew that they were going to come in, but we never knew that they were going to come in there that way. That was really a big surprise, the way that they came in the yard. We thought they were going to come in there and knock some heads and bust some heads open and that kind of way. And once we start seeing the helicopters, and they start shooting the gas pellets, and I start seeing people getting open up with shotguns, you know, then I knew that they were really coming in there in a violent, violent way.
The Chancellor has said people are dying in there. And I agree with that. I think that there are people that are dying in there. And the scene is I'm going to cut this back. Helicopters are still flying overhead. It seems there was announcements from the helicopter right above me to the inmates below that they should put their hands on their heads and come out. I don't know whether anyone has died inside. And I'm upset. It's unfortunate what has happened here. Whatever happens, after the situation here at Attica, a penal system here in the United States and the people who are kept in this out of them will never be the same.
As the inmates surrendered, they were herded into an adjacent yard.
We were made to strip, lay in the mud, face down, and crawl to a guard 10 to 20 feet away from the guard that had you stripped. At that point, that guard would mark an X with white chalk on the back of select inmates, who were then removed from the mud physically by two additional guards, placed in a line to run a gauntlet of correction officers, to be beaten all the way to another cell block.
You know, you gotta let me explain it this way. You know, it was very, very barbaric, you know, very, very cruel, you know, and I really feel it. You know, what they really did, you know, they ripped our clothes off, and they made us crawl on the ground like we were animals. You know, and they snatched me in, they laid me on a table, you know, and they beat me in my testicles, and they buried me with cigarettes, and they dropped hot shells on me, and they put a football up under my throat, and they kept telling me that it would drop. They was going to kill me. And I really felt, you know, after seeing so many people shot, for no apparent reason, that they really were going to do this.
Armed rebellion of the type we have faced threatens the destruction of our free society. We cannot permit that destruction to happen. It has indeed been an agonizing decision.
We had predicted the day before that it was going to be a massacre. Herman Badillo turned to me and said, I don't know what the hurry was. He said, there's always time to die. And I don't know what the hurry was either. You know, those guys weren't going anywhere. They were inside 30-foot walls. It was September. It was getting cold up there. The food was running out. The sanitary conditions were bad. The place smelled awful. I mean, that sense of freedom that the guys had to begin with, but just before being out of their cells, that was beginning to wear away in the reality of their situation. I don't know what the hurry was. They could have waited 2 days, 3 days, 4 days. Those guys would have given up. They didn't have to go in and kill them all. But they did.
39 men were killed in the assault. 29 inmates and 10 hostages. Among the dead, inmate leader Elliot Barkley. 89 men were seriously wounded. Hostage Michael Smith was shot 4 times in the abdomen. 3 inmates were found stabbed to death, killed earlier by other prisoners. Initial reports by state officials that the hostages had died of slashed throats were refuted by the medical examiner.
The first 8 autopsies were on the cases identified to us as hostages. All 8 cases died of gunshot wounds.
The medical examiner's finding was significant. The inmates had no firearms. Gunfire by state troopers and prison guards was responsible for all the deaths during the retaking of the prison.
What do you do during those moments when the assault was actually taking place, the order had been given?
Well, I kept in touch by phone, and I'll never forget the moment when the report was given that 14 guards had come out alive, and while I was on the phone with Bobby Douglas, he said, now it's 15, now it's 16, now it's 17, he said, now 18, and we went up to 21. And I want to tell you, I just was absolutely overwhelmed. I just didn't see how it was possible with 1,200 men in there, armed with electrified barricades, with trenches, with a pledge, which they said that they would all go right down fighting to the last man, how it was going to be possible.
What does this tell you about the prisoners, Governor?
Pardon me?
What does this tell you about the prisoners, the fact that so many men did emerge unharmed?
You're talking now about...
Well,
I think what it tells is that the use of this gas is a fantastic instrument in a situation...
Governor, after that order had been given, did you pray?
Not after. I prayed before.
In towns near Attica, people gathered to mourn the dead hostages. In the cities, families and friends carried the bodies of the dead inmates to their graves. In a country troubled by unrest, the call for law and order remained popular. But many wondered, was the nation well served by law enforcement used to silence voices of dissent? And was America willing to maintain order, no matter what the cost?
There's too many of you to cry. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you die.
Tomorrow night, the 1970s, America's promise of full equality is tested. Boston is divided as a federal court orders busing to desegregated schools. As black...
Okay, I'll ask the question. Is it audio or is it just me? Janice, are you there?
I'm sorry, I was talking. I had muted my phone. Thank you for being with us. You're listening to Our Common Ground. We have just heard a historical record of the uprising and rebellion at Attica Prison. And I want to say to people that this all happened, it did not start on September 9th. There was unrest for months in Attica Prison. The governor knew it, the government knew it, the FBI knew it. You have to understand that you put it in the context that on August 21st, 1971, George Jackson had been murdered at San Quentin by a guard. He was the author of the Soledad Brothers, and that book was being, and those books were being, that copy is of those books were being passed through Attica all summer. And this happened against the background of mass revolutionary black power and prisoners movement in the U.S. There had been a four-day revolt that began in other prisons throughout the year. But, folks, this happened in America. And if you think that the conditions in the prisons where our young brothers are going today is any different, we got to talk. Our number is 1-347-838-9852. You're listening to Our Common Ground. We'd like to get your response. We've got a lot to do. We're going to go on break, and when we come back, we'll take your calls.
Oh, we can play some family songs tonight. Y'all ready? Are y'all ready to say yes? Y'all ready to say yes?
This is Our Common Ground at Blog Talk Radio, speaking truth to power and ourselves.
I want to know why I'm fine one minute and the next my body aches so bad I can't move.
I want to know why my hair is falling out. I'm only 17.
I'm tired all the time. Now, this rash. I just want to know what's going on.
When you don't have the right answers, it may be time to ask your doctor the right question. Could I have lupus? For answers, for support, for hope, visit couldihavelupus.gov or call 1-800-994-9662. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office on Women's Health and the Ad Council.
Our Common Ground, transforming truth to power, one show at a time. Our Common Ground, speaking truth to power and ourselves. I'm Janet Grant. I'll be listening. Common Ground in our chat room. We've got a big crowd tonight. Thank you, Perry Steele and Rags and Twee 1968. YJ is in our chat room and Doc Don. And oh, wow, Miss India Declare and House Music Lover. We have Ifia in Wanganza. And we have Chief Oso. And where would I be without you, Alpho? I had to take a break, Alpho. Sometimes when I revisit the issue of Attica, I just get a little bit filled up.
the truth of the matter is that in this country, because there was what we're seeing now, the resentment of a voice on the part of black people, and there certainly was a great deal more activism going on there. Nobody paid attention. Nobody paid attention to what was going on in Attica until September 9th. And then some people, and the brothers who you heard their voices, they were absolutely right. This country thinks about who we house in prisons as people that, one, ought to be there, two, are no longer human.
Well, 60% were black or Hispanic. So that,
and the guards were 100%
white. 100% white.
Our number is 347-838-9852. If you'd like to join us on a conversation about your response to looking at Attica in 1971 and looking at where we send our boys and girls, our young men and women, our uncles, our aunts, into prison. Because most large prisons are far worse off than they were in 1971. Because the overcrowding is greater. Because of the accentuation of privatized prisons, the system of rehabilitation and programs that have to do with reentry and preparing prisoners to come back into our communities are almost non-existent in the private prisons.
Well, I was about to say the rehabilitation of a prisoner is a long gone for conclusion. It's not happening.
Mm-hmm.
It's not happening. They're not looking to rehab them. They're just looking to house them.
Well, I one of the reasons that I think we have to continue to revisit Attica, it simply is because, you know, most of Attica prisoners were there as a result of plea bargaining. Of 32,000 felony indictments a year in New York State in that year, 4,000 to 5,000 only were tried. And we have in our community people who are going to prison and they plea bargain because they see no other options, whether it's money for proper representation, whatever it is. And I think that we have to keep the story of Attica because, you know, these prisoners had been negotiating for months. This was nothing new to this prison administration. And on the morning of September 9th, two brothers inside of cell block B got into a scuffle. Some guards took over the situation, took them to isolation, and a rumor went through the entire prison that they were being tortured. And to them, that was the end of the line. That was the end of the line. So to our listeners, I want you to really know the story, to develop a voice around prison reform, prison rehabilitation, and the role in which and the authority for which prisons have in our society. There is no reason why, if we say who we are, Alpho, that we shouldn't insist upon from our community. There should be a loud voice from our community that prisons in this country must, at the very minimum, have policies which treat prisoners humanely, that guards ought to be carefully screened and administration people ought to be carefully screened, and that people in charge face consequences in the same way as prisoners face consequences.
Well,
you know, and I know we have a listener who is has a great deal of experience as a prison guard. And yes, those people put their lives on the line every day, which is why it is even more important for us to live, have some principles of human rights that operates within our prisons.
Well,
our number is, our number is 347-838-9852. We'll take your calls. We're going to go to 405. Good evening, 405. Please tell us who you are. I respect you. Hotep.
Hello, Janice and Alpha.
Oh, my brother.
Hey, Dr. Don.
Yes, you know, this takes me back quite a few years. But on this topic that we're discussing tonight, let me tell you some of my personal experience. And I wish Information Man was here, and I hope he's listening. But let's go back to the 60s and 70s and look at the situation, because of our segregation, discrimination in this country, and the way we have been treated and were treated and are treated, and as we have been viewed as now obsolete, or back then, obsolete workforce. If you don't have a job, if you're not on public assistance or some other means of making it, usually you're going to end up in the prison industrial complex. Home life bad. I can remember coming up, and I had a tough home life, and I kept running away, and finally, to get away from that situation, I stole something from J.C. Penney and took off with a hobo on a train from Iowa to Kansas City. And the song that was out at the time was, "I'm going to Kansas City, Kansas City, here I come." Remember that?
Yeah.
And so,
I do.
And so by the time that song came out, I was about 12, 13, something like that, 14. And I finally was put into the juvenile facility for the state. And there I sort of grew up in the complex, the prison for kids, juvenile, and it was an experience. I got out after a certain amount of time. In there, I learned how to sew, I learned how to play chess, and I learned how to box and fight, because if you got into a scrap, all they did to you was put you in isolation, but before you went to isolation, they gave you a pair of boxing gloves with whoever your opponent you were fighting, and that was going to be the entertainment for the weekend, because you went down to the ring, and they put you into the ring with whoever you had gotten to an altercation with, and y'all just fought it out. After the fight, over to the hole. And so this reminds me of just how we are in this country, how we are viewed in this country. Nothing's changed.
Well, it tells you we don't prize justice, doesn't it?
Well, of course. Attica was 54% black. The rest Hispanic or Puerto Rican.
And let me just add this, Don. I hate to keep interrupting you, but, you know, one of the I was writing – I was writing up the papers that were going into the administration, the summary of conversations that people like David Rothberg and Ken Jackson and Mel Rivers were going in and having conversations. And you were talking about people who weren't being allowed to have a shower but once a week and getting one roll of toilet paper once a week.
Yes, it's inhumane. But who cares? Who cares about prisoners? You know, who cares about prisoners, especially now? I mean, you have these right-wing people out here that could care less about the conditions of prison. Let's look at prison today. Let's look at these prisons to where we have control units. And in a control unit, a prisoner can be is housed in a little 6x8 cell. Not much room. They're there for 22 to 23 hours every day. They don't eat together. They don't exercise together. There are no work opportunities for them or religious services together.
So
they exist permanently on permanent lockdown. And they get away with it because the officials state that it's not punishment. But it's an administrative measure for them to place them in this control unit.
They
can stay there for as long as the prison's officials want them to stay there, and they don't have to give any reason whatsoever. And
that's exactly what we have.
Right.
But let's get to the real issue, Don, and the real issue is we better get smart about our investment and our understanding about the prison system, because who's there? Us.
Yeah, but we better get smart, and getting smart means that, you know, we don't need to be in prison. We need to hold this government accountable to where there are decent jobs, to where there are less barriers to employment, to education, and the whole nine yards, social issues. But we have no social issues,
right.
No social programs, nothing to address that, because we are involved in war. We're a wartime nation. And so who cares? Who in the hell cares about 13 to 14% of the population of black people? Who?
Yes.
Us.
Yes.
But us. And what about our representatives? They have not said anything about these conditions.
Well, we don't have...
They're too busy defending themselves from political trials and et cetera.
Yeah.
Nobody cares
yeah.
about the prisoner. Nobody.
Mm-hmm.
That's
well,
my opinion.
One of the things that we have to understand is that we have to be concerned about education before they go to prison as a remedy to the stream. But we also need to understand that we have, since Ronald Reagan's administration, a total retrenchment on educational and development programs for prisoners in American prisons. Why? Because the privatizers have decided that it must be profit.
Sure, it's profit, but it's designed profit and it's guaranteed profit because of the social conditions under which we have the social conditions under which we must live funnels and channels this industrial complex. And let's look at it. As far as our youth is concerned, there's no more running away now. What they do now is join these gangs. because of the very things that I'm talking about. You know, there's no jobs for them. They have no family structure. If you'll look at our statistics on marriage and fatherless, motherless homes, broken homes, dysfunctional family, whatever you want to call it. So they have the gang activity. That's their family.
Yeah.
And look at the dropout rate. If we got a 47-50% dropout rate in high school, what does that tell you about the future of our youth?
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
So we need to, you know, that has an impact on the subject matter tonight. And until we deal with and address these issues, we're just going to see more and more of the same. And pretty soon we're going to look around and we're not going to be here. Our population is going to be so diminished because of lack of reproduction, and et cetera, and what else is going on in this world in order to get rid of.
It has become a business, and every business needs a product. And they sell the product to the United States government to pay for.
These towns, just like Letty Rep is saying, these towns, these little small towns around my state here in Oklahoma, their only industry that they have is prison.
Yep.
And so they're building prisons in these small towns and they're putting these people who do not look like us to work.
In them. That's right. Hey, Don, I enjoyed your comments. I really did. You always make some very fertile observations, and we're going to stay on this issue of prisons because I think that we can't afford to keep thinking that we can say, oh, they committed a crime, so they ought to be in prison. Some of them ought to be in
prison. No, you can't say that, Janice. I'm going to get off, but see, I was fortunate. I was able to get out of the cycle before it tainted me to where I was would not be able to make a living or get an education, et cetera. I joined the service,
mm-hmm.
and I was fortunate to be during the Vietnam War, and so I was fortunate to be able to get away and have different opportunities, options, okay? And so I just want to say that, you know, and yeah, we need to deal with it, but we've got a long struggle ahead of us. And so that's all I have to say. Thank you, Janice.
Thank you, Don. Thank you so much for your call. You know, it's amazing, Alpha, that we do have the insight. We do understand these things. In our chat room, Asiya is pointing out that Dr. Mutulu Shakur points out that once we did the jobs, now we are the jobs, and that as you have pointed out in the chat room, schools are just holding cells, and Ifia goes on to say it's not dropout, it's pushout. And those are the things that we've got to focus on. Those are exactly the things that we've got to focus on.
You know, Janice, I've often said this about the temperature of this culture in the African-American community. We have lost two generations, and we're well on our way to losing a third. And as those generations reproduce, they simply reproduce more and more, I won't say ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
I would have to say that when the parents are unknowing, uneducated, they can only produce and raise uneducated. And until and unless we can, you know, I am a product of the public school system, but I did not have to go down that same road. When they talk about people slipping through the cracks, there are people who were a product of the same system, and they came out and they were very successful, and they continue to be successful. Now they are not the norm; they are the exception. because of the way the schools are structured, because of the way the family life is structured, because of the way or the lack of education that the parents bring to the table. It's not just, you know, we are aware. We in the chat room, we that are listening to this program are aware. But the people who are not aware are not listening. They are not listening. They are not a part of this conversation. They are not being enlightened. There it is, Saturday night. The moon is bright. Can I get some Earth, Wind, and Fire background music? Because that's exactly what's going on. The people who need to listen aren't listening. And that is the problem. Ignorance is breeding ignorance. People just don't have, they don't have the motivation to educate themselves. And I'm not saying all of them, but look at the dropout rate. Look at how high the dropout rate has gone up. And as the dropout rate goes up, the funding of our schools and our community goes down. And it's just a vicious cycle. It may even be one that may be too far gone to come back. We may
you
not be able
so?
To claw back. But at some point in time, someone has to come up with a narrative that will reach these not ignorant students, these ignorant parents. But then they are a product of the same system that they're sending their children through. And the killingest part about it is that these children are not ignorant, they're not dumb, they're smart. And all they need is, you know, is that opportunity. And like I said, somewhere in the system, and they seize the opportunity that they have. And be it because of the parents, be it because they have two parents, whatever the scenario is, that's what they do. And despite the negatives, they still achieve.
Well, we've certainly got to get more focused in our community about what the real priorities are. And I can't say that enough, that we've got to get smart about how we expend our political capital, how we expend our engagement in our own community. And that was one of the things that Ron Walters was a big, you could never go to a meeting with Ron Walters without him talking about civic engagement and how important it was. I know over the last year, much of what he talked about was about what it meant for us, what it challenged for us as a people because of the election of President Barack Obama. Alpha, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking about who I think has been a brilliant artist in our community. A tribute to the birthday, what would have been the birthday of Tupac Shakur. You're listening to Our Common Ground at Blog Talk Radio. Our number is 347-838-9852. And when we come back, we'll be looking at Tupac.
This is Our Common Ground.
Oakley Carmichael. In this country, you were to think that white people were gods, that they had the right to give us our freedom. And so what we had to do was to beg them or to act the way they want us to act before they gave us our freedom. We must stop seeking to imitate white society. We must create for ourselves to save our very humanity. Because the fight for black power in this country is indeed a fight to civilize a barbaric country.
My life was going downhill fast. Everybody was on my case. Now, I kept hoping that life would change real soon. I knew drinking too much messed up my life. A friend suggested I check out AA. It worked. I found myself in an AA group. Finally, I've got my act together. Alcoholics Anonymous. It works. Look us up. Check your phone book, newspaper, or AA.org.
This is awful. Hosting the best of Pushback Talk Radio.
Reload Pushback. Every Saturday, the Mo Alpha Show at Truthworks Network, following the Alpha Show at blogtalkradio.com/alpha. 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 4 p.m. Reload on Truthworks Network Radio. It's all Alpha, just damn.
We're so glad that all of you are with us here on Saturday night, open mic at Our Common Ground. Our number is 347-838-9852. I'm Janice Graham, and what's your name?
My name?
Hey, did you fall asleep?
No, I didn't. But, you just caught me off guard when you asked, well, I thought you had someone else on the line.
No.
I'm Alpha, that's me.
Alpha keeps my memory, helps me with my memory problems at Our Common Ground, and I am so, this is a good brother, a really good brother. Thank you all for participating in our chat room, and we want to take a few minutes. Alpha, you know, one of the things that bothers me is that we, on one hand, we want to talk about the problems that our children face in this society, the cultural problems, the economic problems, and then we want to talk about how they participate in violence, but we really don't understand what they're saying. One of the reasons that my only rap artist that I listen to his words, but I always have to have the words in front of me. And because he was a powerful bard, there is no doubt that he was absolute powerful bard, and he was one of the young people in our recent history who had a real grasp of what was happening around him. And that's what his music has led me to conclude. And I know that there are a lot of people in my generation who talk bad about Tupac, and he was flawed like all of us. He was flawed in a way that was almost self-destructive, but he was a genius in his own way as well. And I just want to play a birthday tribute to him. If you'd like to talk about Tupac, our number is 347-838-9852. And I'm sure you'll have some thoughts about the whole genre of rap music, but his life as well. Too short. Much too short.
Thank you.
My name is Tupac Shakur, and I attend Tampa Pi High School, and I'm 17 years old.
Each generation finds its own heroes and prophets. In 1996, one tattooed political poet, whose music and voice reached out to millions of people across the world, was silenced. The media portrayed him as a thug, focusing public attention more and more on his alleged crimes rather than his music. He spoke of poverty, injustice, equality, and the harsh realities of life. Was he just a reflection of the times, or someone who made a difference?
Some kids think that he's still alive. It's almost funny to me, because he couldn't have been quiet this long. There'd been no way in the world he could be quiet this long.
I think Tupac's alive as any one of us, in the sense of I can still feel him.
He is still alive. As far as I'm concerned, you know, we don't die, we multiply.
I think Tupac's here every day because I see the tattoo on my daughter's shoulder and it's so lifelike, you know.
The 1960s were a time of turmoil and liberation. Americans were confronted with the power of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. One group to rise from this atmosphere was the Black Panthers. The group believed that the only way to achieve black liberation was to form a black militia armed with enough firepower to fight the oppressive white government. Afeni Shakur, Tupac's mother, was in the forefront of the Black Panther movement.
My mother was a Black Panther, and she was really involved in the movement, you know, just black people bettering themselves and things like that.
He was a soldier from here. You seen it with the upbringing. You seen Pac, he had the fire in his eye.
You can't exempt this guy from his environment. His mother was a Panther Party operative. She was socially conscious. She guided her boy in the right direction. Huey Newton was in his 20s when he started the Panthers, who was a voracious reader. And Tupac probably wanted to replicate that. He wanted to imitate that.
Afeni Shakur, pregnant with Tupac, was arrested on conspiracy charges along with 20 other Black Panthers. Accused of plotting to blow up Manhattan landmarks, she faced up to 150 years in prison. She successfully defended herself and was acquitted of all charges. 1 month after the trial, Tupac Amaru Shakur was born.
Met him the first time at the Armory in New York City at 168th Street. Had gone over to hear Minister Louis Farrakhan speak at a rally, and Afeni was there with him. He was a tiny baby, and he was about 2 months old.
Afeni never revealed publicly who Tupac's father was. She lived briefly with Mutulu Shakur, who had become Tupac's stepfather and spiritual advisor during his younger years. Mutulu was eventually taken from Tupac.
Dr. Mutulu Shakur, a political prisoner. Been locked down since 86, 87. He got 60 years on the RICO Act. He's accused allegedly of liberating Asada Shakur, bank robberies, armored truck heists, all that.
I was a man in Tupac's life who had a commitment. I was a man in Tupac's life who probably had a commitment to the struggle more than to the family. He learned a lot from the people, not from what was said by the people. He hung around with dope fiends, he hung around with gangsters, he hung around with oppressed people, he hung around with struggle. People were struggling for things. He listened to the meetings. He was at all the meetings. You know, he was hanging. He was a part of that struggle as a young child. In 1981, the depression was intensified, and him and the family and etc. had to go and run from the FBI, and the FBI would go into their schools and intimidate them and try to find out where I was at, where his aunt was at, where Cy was at. Most children don't know that.
It was like I was given the responsibility before I wanted it, and so now I can't really differentiate what great responsibility is because I've had it for so long.
Fanny and Pac are a lot alike, you know what I'm saying? They're very articulate, and she's a good person to learn things from.
My mother taught me three things: respect, knowledge, search for knowledge. It's an eternal journey. That's like my aunt cut the line. 360 degrees, find knowledge, always. And she taught me to not be quiet. To, if there's something on my mind, speak it.
Years of internal fighting and the efforts of the FBI to undermine the Panthers eventually led to the party's demise.
All the party members had a hard time right after the party was dissolved of getting into the workforce, and especially somebody like Fink. You know, she ended up homeless on the streets of New York, of Boston. You know, she had a hard time. She ended up on drugs.
We moved out of New York because all of these, because of my mother's choices, they figured out who she was, and she couldn't keep a job. That should be illegal. So she lost her job, and of course, we were, like, stranded in New York.
With the dissolve of the Black Panther Party and a search for a better life, Afeni and her family left Harlem.
So we moved to Baltimore. Baltimore has the highest rate of teenage pregnancy, the highest rate of AIDS within the black community, the highest rate of teens killing teens, and the highest rate of teenage suicide, and the highest rate of blacks killing blacks in Baltimore, Maryland. And this is where we chose to live. So as soon as I got there, being the person I am, I said, no, I'm changing it. So I started a Stop the Killing campaign and Safe Sex campaign and AIDS prevention campaign and everything.
Tupac auditioned for and was accepted into the Baltimore School for the Arts. Majoring in acting, he became a model student. In Baltimore, he wrote his first rap. It was about gun control and inspired by the death of a close friend. Again, looking for a better life, Afeni packed up the family and moved to California. Tupac believed leaving that school affected him so much. He saw that as the point where he got off track.
And I came to California to escape that violence that I escaped New York for. Then I went to Baltimore, escaped Baltimore for, came to California. Come to Marin City, I've seen already death. I mean, this lady slashed a man's throat because he spit on a kid.
This is door one, building 89. It's in Marin City in the jungle, the J-Town. This was kind of like the place we wrote a lot of the first, you know, the first songs. Okay.
Follow me with your camera. Because, first of all, he's staying in the living room. And his sister had my son's room. Babe, this is Tupac's sister's room.
Yeah, this is where we used to write all the songs at. Yeah. Especially we used to be mad because we was all...
And that side window, when his mama leave, all the girls come to the back. And he let me into the slide. Okay? So when I'm in my room, man, right here, in my bed, and something goes...
I was in the training room. Sometimes here in the living room, we'll do some writing, but... You know, his mama would kick us out, send us to the back. During the early days, we were broke. We wanted to be rappers, and we got befriended by a lot of people in the street, like dope dealers, pimps, all the people that you think are the wrong type of people. I can honestly say that none of those people tried to draw us into that lifestyle. So a lot of people got behind us and helped us get there. We got caught up in the whole aspect of wanting a ball, wanting to have jewelry, wanting to have nice cars from watching them. But the revolutionary aspect of it came from Tupac's mother and the things she was teaching him, he taught a lot of us.
I feel like if you can't respect yourself, then you can't respect your race, then you can't respect another's race, then you can't respect, you know, it just has to do with respect, like my mother taught me. So what we're doing is starting the Black Panthers again in Marin City, just getting first teaching pride and then teaching education, and then we'll see where it goes.
Yo, this is Tupac, and I clown around when I hang around with the underground. Girls used to frown, sing them down when I come around. Gas me, and when they pass me, they used to lay back. Find any great man, black or white, I'm gonna study him, learn it, so he can't be great to me no more. Like Machiavelli. And that's why I don't say my name's not Machiavelli, my name is Machiavelli. I took it, that's mine. He gave me that, you know what I mean? I took that, it's like, and I don't feel no guilt. That motherfucker, all these motherfuckers stole from us forever.
of taking back what's mine.
Right.
It's just that they recorded it when he said it.
Right.
It's probably something he took from us that
right.
they didn't let us
know. Right, right.
So there's no shame. You know what I mean? That's me. That's me right fucking there.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I don't give a fuck if y'all don't like me. I got the bomb. Can't nobody touch me.
Mm-hmm.
Won't nobody rush me. Something we doing right. That's that capitalism shit. Because you can feed your kids with that thought.
Wake up in the morning, just to face another day. It seems no matter how hard you try to fight it. Nothing
When I said I was living thug life, believe me, it was all real.
There's a kind of fascination with the thug.
As sure as thug life is tattooed across my stomach, it will always be a part of me.
Tupac Shakur represented at once the expression of the evil that needed to be resisted and the need to resist that evil. This is why people were so upset with him.
Just recently, this lady wrote me named Clovis Benjamin from San Francisco. She was writing me, telling me about her nephew had just been killed. The day before he died, he was like, I'm going to get Tupac from his head. So she wrote me to tell me, you know, they played Dear Mama at the funeral, boom, boom. And that touched me, you know, and I was like, what can I do? Is there anything I can do? Let's do some concerts. Let's do some organizing. I was like, if she's strong enough to keep going and make a difference, then I can be strong enough to make a difference. And that kind of focuses me back on what I should be doing and not letting me, like, veer off back into the lifestyle I was living, because it's real easy to do that.
On the one hand, he could articulate somebody dying, somebody wanting to die, somebody believing he or she was going to die, and the suffering that that encouraged. On the other hand, he could so hopelessly, nihilistically, some might argue, engage in the very things that would lead to their death.
A lot of people try to put out the bad thing, try to, you know, say he did this and this, and who really know, you know?
These opposing forces, rooted in his two-headed father and mother, left Tupac in a constant state of contradiction, both within himself and to the rest of the world. The two wills formed a destructive combination.
In the sense that within Tupac himself was both the possibility of the solution as well as the contradiction of that solution.
On September 13, 1996, after 6 days in critical condition, Tupac Amaru Shakur was pronounced dead. He was only 25. Quincy Jones said if Malcolm X died at 25, he would have been a street hustler named Detroit Red. If Martin Luther King died at 25, he would have been a local Baptist minister who had not yet arrived on the national scene. And if I would have died at 25, I would have been known as a trumpet player and struggling composer, just the sliver of my life potential.
Tupac was a prophet. He knew things that none of us seen yet. And Tupac ain't never let me roll in to pull no gun on no black man. Cause he seen a lot of brothers gone, a lot of sisters gone, a lot of children gone. Tupac wasn't no gangster. I rolled with Tupac. We came up together. Tupac was a soldier.
A private memorial service was held for Tupac on a secluded beach in Malibu. In attendance were close friends and relatives, including his mother, Fanny Shakur. Some of his ashes were scattered into the sea.
We threw all the gifts in the ocean for him, and we threw the chicken wings and the Hennessy and his favorite pictures, jewelry. Everybody brought something. Everybody said a little something. We brought drums and bongos, and people spoke, and we had fires burning. That was his funeral.
You know, could we have done something different? Could we have said more? Could we have stood up to the forces? And all of us shoulder some of the responsibility.
It just appalls me that nobody has been arrested for those two deaths. You know, and it's just been like, it's like a big cloud with a question mark on it. And you know somebody in Las Vegas and Los Angeles, or both, know exactly what happened.
Just at the odd of time, I just miss him. Just miss being able to holler at him like, dude, you know, I'm going through this problem and shit. You know what I'm saying?
It's like you're happy about having successful records with Tupac, producing him and all that, but at the same time, it's like he's not here to enjoy what you're enjoying, you know, while I'm alive.
And however it went down with them taking him away, he's still not gone. And still is going to be here for a long time to come. And even if music still wasn't coming from all the albums that's out now, we got enough to hold us over for centuries.
Pac showed me, just be yourself and be true to everything you believe in, and it'll come. It don't come on this album, it'll come on the next album.
No matter how bad it may get, just keep going, because you only fail when you give up.
He gave me pride. You know, he gave me love. He gave me inspiration. I don't think he realized how great he was. You know, I don't think he fully realized how much people admired him, you know, and thought of him.
I always wanted to make a book out of my life, like a fairy tale. Raised by the Black Panthers and strung out.
Yeah, we thugging y'all, to the 90s. Peace to my nigga Kato.
Out here, man. The American dream, man. The American dream. Thug style.
Whatever might have been said about his thug style and rough lyrics, Tupac Shakur's gangster rap music made him a huge star. And at the time of his death, he had every reason to think he had finally made it. Big houses, fancy cars, beautiful women, and lots of money.
What does a thug yearn for? Success and to be respected.
He absolutely thought he was quite rich and that his family would, you know, be rich forever.
Fanny Shakur, who raised her son in poverty, often homeless and at times addicted to drugs, that was a huge accomplishment for the whole family.
Please remember that my great-grandmother was a slave, my grandmother was a sharecropper, my mother was a factory worker, and I was a legal worker. Do you understand? And so this represents the first time in our life, in our memory, ever, that we have been able to enjoy the American dream, and that's what Tupac brought to his family.
Now, we was once two brothers up I don't want to be 50 years old at a BET, we shall overcome, achievement award. You know what I'm saying? Man, every time I speak, I'm going to shiver. I'm not saying I'm going to rule the world or I'm going to change the world, but I guarantee that I will spark the brain that will change the world.
And he did change the world in so many ways, Alpha. He really did. He was a fearless, fearless voice. Despite all the flaws, despite all the misdirection, he was fearless. And one of the things that I want to point out as I read his lyrics over and over is that his brilliance came as a result of a mother teaching him hope and liberation as a life entitlement. So he approached the world understanding what his entitlement was as a human being. Happy birthday, and we remember you. Tupac Mutulu Shakur. So, Alpha, am I going to get you as someone who I can have listening to some Tupac tomorrow?
Nope. Tomorrow's Sunday. NFL.
I'll send you a couple of tunes. We're going to go to our phones. Our number is 347-838-9852. We're going to bypass talking about 9/11 tonight, but we will come back to it because the sacred ground has not been resolved, because we do have to get to our tribute to Dr. Ron Walters. You're on the air at Our Common Ground. I respect you, Hotep.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello, this is Rags.
Rags.
So how y'all doing?
Rags, how you been?
Rags, my brother, my brother.
It's so good to hear your voice, and I know every time you hear me say that, you pause. given our history.
I remember when.
Yeah, but you know what? That was one of the best lessons that I received, and you took me over a bar that I needed to pass.
Yes. I understand that bar, too, because sometimes I can't get beyond the beat. I have to read the words. And the more I read the words, the more I want to hear him.
Right on.
I love to hear this young brother.
I want to share something about the Tupac story. And there's some people being left out. I knew Tupac. I lived and worked in Marin City. My sister-in-law is Linda Pratt, who was married to Geronimo Pratt. And I'm sure you know who Geronimo Pratt is. And when Tupac
Another
was living
soldier.
In the projects, he and his mother was on drugs. His sister and he lived with my sister-in-law. And, and I never hear anybody say anything about Ashaki. And that's Geronimo. That is who he lived with. Ashaki is Linda Pratt, Geronimo's wife. And that was the name that he gave her. And I just kind of disappoints me that I know the contribution she made to him also, to his existence. Tupac visited my home. He told me when he was like 15 years old that he was going to be famous. He used to walk around with a notebook with all his poems in it. And, and he was a great kid. But at the same time, there were some other people that have been very instrumental, but I've never heard anybody acknowledge those people. And I just wanted to say that.
Well, thank you so much. One of the things I do look forward to this weekend is watching the new documentary about Tupac and his relationship with Mike Tyson, because this was a man who had some deep ability, capacity to love. When you think about the trials that he went through with his mother, and you listen to his piece, Mama.
Oh, yes.
He understood so much. He was very deep. Rags, I'm so glad to have you with us tonight, and we hope that you'll be here with us every Saturday night.
Well, you know,
I have never known you since Coz Carson to pick up the phone and call on a show.
That's true. Well, you know, this... The memories of Tupac and people who are in my family who participated. Well, I'm actually not married to her sister anymore. I'm divorced from her. For all you ladies listening out there, I just felt
Match.com and our common ground.
Anyway, it's good to hear your voice, and please continue.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much, Rags. Good to hear from you.
You take
care,
Rags.
Wow, Alpho. I tell you. We're going to try to. I haven't talked to India Declare about it, but I've talked to Alpho about it today, and we're going to try to have a U.S. Talk Network reunion of all of the hosts from U.S. Talk Network. What? I did talk to you about it. Don't you start nothing up here on the microphone just because you got a microphone.
I just don't remember.
Sure you do. Thank you all for being with us. We want to bring to you the best of Black Talk programming that you can find to provide an option. Dr. D is in the house.
Yeah.
We are so glad to see her. For our call from Don, we thank you so very much. And Alpho, thank you once again for being with us. Let me tell you that at TruthWorks Network this week, we are going to be providing some of the speeches of Dr. Ron Walters on Monday. And on Tuesday, we'll be running audio documentary on Tupac Shakur. The Attica piece will be available on TruthWorks by Wednesday. And we hope that you will join us at TruthWorks. We we do want to close out tonight with a tribute to Dr. Ronald Walters, who was one of my mentors. And for those of you who do not know who Dr. Ron Walters was, you should know who he is. Today on my blog, I wrote In Memoriam to Dr. Ronald W. Walters, African-American scholar and activist, made his transition on yesterday. We thank him for his dedication, loyalty, and genius on behalf of African people across the globe and his loyalty to the descendants of the slaves of America. He lent his mind and his entire adult life to our empowerment and welfare. And from our hearts, we thank him for his service. He was a loyal member of our Common Ground family, a mentor, a frequent guest from our beginnings at WPOM AM Radio in West Palm Beach, Florida in 1985. Throughout our broadcast experiences, our political campaigns for Jesse Jackson Sr., he was always available to share his brilliant and insightful voice. He was a treasured guest, powerful on-air teacher, and off-air mentor. May he dance above our head now as a dear and cherished ancestor. I am so grateful for his mentorship, his friendship, and his brotherhood. It is such a loss to us all. Thank you all for being with us tonight. Alpho, thank you.
Thank you for being with us here tonight at Our Common Ground. This is Janice Graham. We hope you'll join us each Saturday night at 10 p.m. for Our Common Ground, Saturday Night Open Mic. Tonight we're going to go out in tribute to a dear friend and mentor and soldier and scholar, Dr. Ronald Walters, who made his transition on yesterday, September 10th. We thank him for his perseverance, for his soldiering, and we hope that the ancestors will dance above our head in celebration of his transition. In the more than 40 years that I have known him, I will say it once again. Thank you, Dr. Ronald Walters. Thank you so much for your service to our people.
Dockham Drugstore was one of the most prominent chains in Wichita. A part of the Rexall franchise, Dockham operated 9 stores in the city, and the downtown location was the place to go for hungry workers and shoppers. Here, white patrons always took precedence over black customers, who were forced to order from a window at the end of the counter and take their food outside. Ron Walters and his cousin, Carol Parks, grew up in Wichita. Carol's mother, Vivian, was president of the local NAACP. The Parks home frequently hosted national black leaders, including Rosa Parks and Franklin Williams, who shared their experiences with Ron and Carol, inspiring them to pursue issues in civil rights. As college students, in 1958, they became president and vice president of the Youth Council, and Chester Lewis became chapter president. Ron and Carol shared their ideas with Lewis and the Youth Council. They proposed that the group conduct a sustained sit-in at Dockham Drugstore to change their policy. To ensure that this effort would be successful, Ron carefully organized and planned the protest himself. He wanted to follow tactics of the Montgomery bus boycott, sitting quietly and not reacting to taunts. To do this, he trained the students for several weeks at a local church to prepare for the difficult situations that might occur.
We used the basement of that church to simulate of what it would be like to sit on the stools, what we would encounter. Would people, you know, try to pour coffee down our back, or cigarettes, burns, or taunts, just what would happen. And we were able to design this so that we then were the perpetrators, and other people who sat on the stools had to react. The point was not to react. The point was to sit with dignity and with purpose and to not be dissuaded.
Ron spoke at local churches, high schools, and organizations to recruit volunteers to participate. Through his efforts, he was able to encourage as many as 40 members to take part in the sit-in. When Vivian Parks and Chester Lewis explained to the national office what the students would be doing, the NAACP strongly advised them to discontinue their efforts because the organization worked through legal means and not protests. Ron was not discouraged, and he proceeded with the plan. Carol Parks was the first to sit down at the Dockham drugstore lunch counter on a test visit. She ordered a Coke, and the waitress, mistaking her for a white patron, served her. When Carol's friend sat down beside her, the waitress asked, "Honey, you're not colored, are you?" Carol replied, "Yes, I am." The waitress then ignored the customers. The following Saturday, July 19th, the sit-in began and students filled the lunch counter stools from just before lunch to closing time, Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. They were occasionally supported by picketers outside.
Each one day, we had some motorcycle-looking toughs come in the drugstore, and I said that, well, they were going to disrupt the place. I got off the stool and called the city police and asked if they wouldn't come.
The officer that arrived told them he was to keep his hands off. Instead, Ron called Turner's Drugstore, the group's base, for assistance. Three carloads of black students arrived in support, and the white youths immediately departed. On August 11, 1958, as the students took their places, the manager walked in and announced, "Serve them." This victory would propel Ron into a career of civil rights involvement. The success at Dockham spread to drug stores across the country. All 9 stores in Wichita were desegregated, and because Dockham was a part of the statewide Rexall chain, all Rexall stores in Kansas changed their policies. The weekend after the policy change at Dockham, Walters described their effort at an NAACP convention in Oklahoma City. A few days later, the Oklahoma City Youth Council began a 2-week sit-in at Katz Drugstore. Because of their success, the Oklahoma City participants shared their story at the 1959 NAACP National Convention, where North Carolina University student Ezra Blair was in attendance. 2 years after the Oklahoma sit-in, Blair and 3 other college students took their seats at a Woolworth's lunch counter in Greensboro, North Carolina, to protest racial discrimination, spurring the sit-in phase of the civil rights movement.
Well, it's my view that much of the blood that was shed in Selma and other places was for a theory of politics. And I think that we, not just because I'm a political scientist, but my 40 years have been spent trying to say that when we line up to vote, we don't just line up to vote as individuals. The classical theory of liberalism is individual liberty. That's why I'm not a liberal. Because we have come from Africa, endured oppression in this country. So when we line up to vote, we line up to vote for power, to empower a community. And so our expectation is, coming out of that movement, was that we would put people in place who would return our voting power to the community in terms of the goods and services that our community needed. So now when we looked at what has happened in this election, the fact that black people have such high expectations can be determined by the fact that we turned out at a rate of 66%. The first time in the history of America, we have turned out higher than the black community, than the white community. They've turned out, yes, let's give ourselves a hand. We have fulfilled the Voting Rights Act. Let's give ourselves a hand. 90% of those who were registered turned out to vote. 95% of those who turned out to vote voted for Barack Obama. The highest levels of political participation in our history.
Mm.
So this tells me, and it ought to tell anybody else, that we have tremendous expectations for this moment of public policy. So when we look at our community, and we look at the fact that we have had somebody ascend to the highest ranks, what we ought to remember is that we are not classical liberals. Because when we had Frederick Douglass, or when we had Jackie Robinson, or whoever we had who manifested individual achievement, while we understood and we applauded and we celebrated that achievement, we did not expect that particular achievement to save the race. And it will not save the race this time without tremendous struggle on our part. So I want to end by saying that what has happened, I think, is that there has been a corner turn. It will not turn unless we help it turn. But what has happened with this election is that a door has been partially opened to create a progressive space for us to step back on the stage of history and to help turn that corner. Now, that's not a Barack moment. That's our movement. We have to do something called civic engagement. Pick up the telephone, engage yourself in politics, demand public policy, hold your elected officials accountable, call Washington, D.C. In other words, get involved. Because too many times we go vote, go home, sit down, let somebody else run our business, let somebody else spend our taxes. We ought to stop that. So I'm thinking that this is a tremendous moment, historical moment. But it is a moment not just for us to celebrate, but for us to think wisely about and determine that we will step back on the stage of history.
The current stalemate. Jane McGregor Burns' concept of transformational leadership is contained in the moral achievement of Abraham Lincoln in changing the context of slavery. We do not know what act will be the hallmark of President Obama's legacy, and therefore whether the comparison is even apt. But we do note that the irony of the context in which both Lincoln and Obama govern is that to a great extent, the force of the old Confederacy and its conservative dogma stood in the way, and therefore the judgment of modern history may not be how Obama will remove this impediment. He cannot. But when the American people will eventually tire of its hold on their possibilities of achieving a new birth of freedom in the 21st century. Thank you.
Brother, Help me, please. But he winds up knocking me back down on my knees. Oh, there have been times that I thought, and I
Hi out there, this is Janice Graham of Our Common Ground. Want to remind you of some of the terrific broadcast shows available to all you talkers. The India Declare Show, Monday through Friday at 11 a.m. and Saturday at 11 a.m. The Alpha Show, every Saturday, 3 p.m. And following that 3 p.m. broadcast, he's at TruthWorks Network at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. And don't forget of all the audio documentary being provided at TruthWorks Network here at Blog Talk Radio. I'm Janice Graham, and I'm sure me and my friends will be listening for you.